WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back from vacation. Thanks to Dave Davies for hosting while I was gone. My guest today is Peter Wolf, who has just released his seventh solo album. From the late 60s to 1983, Wolf was the frontman of the Jay Giles Band, and his electrifying performances led many people to assume he was Jay Giles. The band had the hits Centerfold, Freeze Frame, and Love Stinks. Before he was in a hit band, Peter Wolf was one of the first DJs on WBCN Radio in Boston when it started its progressive rock format. He hosted a show called the All Night House Party. When he was in his teens, he got to meet and befriend some of the blues musicians who were his heroes, like Muddy Waters and John Lee Hooker. Wolf's new album, Midnight Souvenirs, reflects his love of country music. Let's hear a track on which Wolf sings a duet with Merle Haggard.
The lovers two by two along the avenue. Such a beautiful sight to see. But as they pass me by, it makes me wanna cry. 'Cause I know it's too late for me. It seems so long ago when someone loved me so, and we were both so young and so free. I thought I still could see how good life used to be, and I know that it's too late for me. The days go by, the days go by.
Peter Wolf, welcome to Fresh Air. Bravo, that is a great song and a great track, and a brilliant idea to get Merle Haggard to sing with you. Did you write this song knowing that you'd be doing it as a duet with Merle Haggard?
No, I wrote this song with a gentleman whose name is Will Jennings. And Will is a very special friend of mine, and he's quite an accomplished songwriter. And Will and I sat down, and this song came out. We were both in that sort of time and place. And I stayed with it for a while, and I just thought, you know, there's just something so classic and so simple. It reminded me of the songs of that great honky-tonk era. And there was a certain sadness about it. And there was a Lefty Frizzell quality, and Merle Haggard embodies most of Lefty's work in many ways. And so Merle seemed to be a natural person to maybe ask if he would choose to participate.
You're so associated with the blues. When did you start listening to country music?
Well, that's a good question. When I was growing up in the Bronx in New York, I was addicted to radio. And in my little three-room apartment, which looked very much like the apartment in the Honeymooners TV show with Jackie Gleason. There was a little kitchen. It was my mother, father, sister, myself, two cats, and a parakeet and a dog. And radio provided me with a great outlet. And I would learn so much about music through radio. But on a certain day, on Thursdays and Fridays, you can get from WWVA, the Wheeling, West Virginia, in the Bronx, you can get that radio station, and it was the coffee-drinking DJ Lee Moore. And he would play this bluegrass, and these guys called Stanley Brothers, and they would sing songs like, "Oh, dear." And, you know, I thought they were women or something. It just was the strangest sound. And it was through that that got me into country music. And also, it was in the era when radio had such a sort of smorgasbord, may I say, of music. So you could have Buck Owens being played right next to a Motown song, right next to a Rolling Stone song or whatever. So it wasn't as segregated musically as it sort of seems to be today.
So I want to play another track from your new CD, Midnight Souvenirs. And this is a duet you do with Shelby Lynn that's co-written with Angelo, who's Angelo, the producer of Kings of Leon. And you want to say anything about writing this song before we hear it?
Well, I knew Angelo up in Boston. He was in a band called Face to Face, and he moved down to Nashville to do some writing. And we had been friends for a long time, written a lot of songs. And one day we were just sitting with two acoustic guitars in his living room, and we just sort of finished the song. And the moment the song got finished, I thought it could be a really interesting duet. And I thought for a second, and boom, Shelby's Lynn name just popped into my mind. And I'm such a fan of Shelby Lynn's. And she has a recording out, if people don't know about it, called I Am Shelby Lynn. And she has a new record coming out, too, as we speak. But I Am Shelby Lynn is one of those great masterpieces. And I remember the first time I heard it, I was riding in a car and I actually had to pull over the side of the road to listen to it. And strangely enough, I called up a friend of mine who was in the music business, and an A&R person by the name of Sue Drew, and I asked if she could help me find Shelby Lynn. And it turned out she said, Pete, I'm meeting with Shelby in an hour. And so the whole thing came together pretty quickly. And as I say, I thought it was destiny knocking. And Shelby and I got together, and this is what you hear.
Okay, so this is Tragedy from Peter Wolf's new CD, Midnight Souvenirs.
I think I won the Fool's Award today. The way I made my baby cry. I can't believe the stupid things I say without one good reason why. I know that life has got its ups and downs. I could take whatever comes around. But if you ever take your love from me, now that would be the tragedy.
That's Tragedy, a duet with Peter Wolf and Shelby Lynn from Peter Wolf's new CD, Midnight Souvenirs. You've had such an interesting life, so I want to go back to the very beginning. Now, if what I've read is true, your grandmother was in Yiddish theater, your father was a singer. So what kind of music were you exposed to when you were a child at home?
Oh, quite a lot. My dad also was in vaudeville, and when he was about 14, 15, he left and joined the Shubert Theater, and he was what they call a chorus boy. And so he was on a train traveling throughout the United States doing plays like Merry Widow and A Student Prince. And he then wanted to become an opera singer, joined the Met Choir, then eventually the Robert Shore Chorale. And so music was around, but he was a very progressive gentleman. He loved all different kinds of music. And when I first encountered Little Richard, I remember him standing in the room and said, man, that's wild. That's great. And he had as much enjoyment hearing Little Richard as I did. And so through him, I got to meet so many interesting people. I got to meet Maria Tallchief, the great ballet dancer and I was a young kid, and I remember sitting on her lap saying, boy, you can really dance.
Now, your older sister danced on the Alan Freed show, is that right?
Mm-hmm. She was on the Alan Freed show, the Big Beat show, and you would go down, and she had some, there were favorites, like on the Dick Clark show, there was certain people started, like the Mouseketeers, started having favorite dancers and writing them fan letters. But I would follow her to the Alan Freed Big Beat shows, and I remember seeing on one show Little Richard, Chuck Berry, Fats Domino, Jerry Lee Lewis. There was Dickie Doo and the Don'ts, the Chantels, and it was just this tremendous pageantry, and that was my baptism into rock and roll, because when Little Richard came out, he just tore up the stage, and each performer would do one or two numbers. And then when Frankie Lyman and the Teenagers came out, that was it. I was just gone for good.
Now, since she danced on the Alan Freed show, and you probably watched and got to see all the dancers and learned the dances, did that help you when you became a front man?
Well, it did. But the thing that really, I think, affected me the most as a performer and as a front person, I went to a place called the High School of Music and Art, which was a specialized, it was a city school, but you needed to take a academic exam to get in. And to this day, I don't know how I got in because I was a terrible student. And I was accepted as an art student. And the school was on 135th Street in Harlem, Convent Avenue. And once a week, religiously, I would go to the Apollo Theater. And for 3 years, every week, I went to the Apollo. And during that time, I saw all the great artists. I saw Dinah Washington. I saw Ray Charles. I saw James Brown. I saw Dyke and the Blazers. I saw Jackie Wilson. I saw Joe Tex. I saw Don Covey. And it just, the list went on. But the showman and the pageantry and the actuality of here came these performers, like the church, were performing for their congregation. And there was, it was sort of one for the money, for two for the show. And even someone like Billy Stewart, who was one of these fantastic singers, who was 320 pounds, he would come out. But by the time he got done, you just fell in love with him. And the way they would tear up a stage, or Jackie Wilson would take off his jacket and pretend he was going to throw it into the audience and just drop it on the side of the stage. It just drove the women wild. And you had Bobby Womack. I remember seeing Bobby up in Boston not too long ago, and he was performing, and it was a great performance. And then Bobby said, man, the women out here look so beautiful. I want to kiss each and every one of you. And he sat on the lip of the stage, and all the women lined up, and Bobby kissed every woman in that audience. And that's what I call showmanship. But also, Terry, if I may, the dancing and the interaction with the audience and communicating with the audience was the art that I learned there at the Apollo Theater. It was very important. And you didn't just come out and do a song. You just came out, and it was your job to get the audience riled up, and not unlike someone in church, where by the end of the performance, the audience was up on their feet. The performer just gave it its all, and it was always 110%.
My guest is singer and songwriter Peter Wolfe. His new album is called Midnight Souvenirs. We'll talk more and hear more of his music after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Peter Wolfe, and he has a new CD called Midnight Souvenirs. Before being a solo artist, he was the frontman for the Jay Giles Band. It's kind of interesting to me that through your father, you knew all about vaudeville because he was in it, your grandmother in Yiddish theaters. So you had this kind of like old school show business in your genes, just like that was the air you breathed. And then when you started getting involved in music, you were really interested in blues and in early blues. And you became friends with some of the older blues musicians during the blues revival era, when they were touring around the country, mostly probably the college circuit, college coffee houses and clubs. And you got to meet Muddy Waters and Helen Wolf and John Lee Hooker. It must have been amazing for you to do that. You must have felt lucky to be coming of age during a time when those performers were there.
Oh yeah, the interesting thing is, a lot of artists or performers and musicians who were playing at that time got to meet Muddy and John Lee because we were all playing in sort of the same kind of venues. But the interesting thing with me is there was this club in Boston called the Club 47 and the Jazz Workshop. And I had an apartment that was not too far away from these venues. And during the breaks, and sometimes these artists would do one or two shows, there'd be a very small dressing room. And I was waiting for Muddy Waters to arrive at this coffee house. And I was sat there from 3 o'clock in the afternoon. I just could not believe he was coming to town. And finally, these two cars, this Cadillac car rolls up, and out comes a station wagon behind it. And the door opens up, and out steps one of the most handsome men I've ever seen. And there was an elegance. In the same way you would see with Duke Ellington, there was just something undescribable. There was just a nobility with this man. He came out, and I walked up, and I said, "Mr. Waters, hi, I'm, such a fan, and any way I can, help you." And he thought I was with the club, so he asked me if I could help him carry some of the equipment in. And I did, and I was in the bathroom, and Otis Spann, who was the piano player, and James Cotton was in the bathroom, unbeknownst. They didn't realize then. I heard Otis Spann say to James Cotton, "This is a coffee house." And James Cotton said, what does that mean? And he goes, they serve coffee. And he goes, "Yeah, no whiskey or anything?" He said, "No, man, they just serve coffee." He said, "Well, what are we going to do?" He said, "I don't know." He said, "Well, can we get some whiskey?" And I came out. I was underage. I was like 17 and a half. I said, "Well, I can get you some whiskey." And he said, "Yeah?" And I said, "Yeah." And so I ran down the street, and I went to a friend's house who was, a little bit older. It was Bob Siggins, was with the Charles River Valley Boys. He was a banjo player. I said, "Bob, can you do me a favor? Can you get me some whiskey and stuff?" So we went out, got a whiskey, and ran back, and I gave it to Otis and James. And that began a kind of friendship. And then they realized I had an apartment. So they said to Muddy, "Hey, Muddy, this young fella has an apartment down the street." And so every day, they were there for about 10 days, they would come and use my apartment as a hanging. And then James Cotton would cook up all sorts of chicken. And it became a clubhouse. And then Muddy would tell Howlin' Wolf, "Hey, there's this young guy has an apartment." So he would come by. Johnny Hooker would come by. And all sorts of musicians would come by, and they would just all hang. And fortunately, I had a tape recorder, and I recorded a lot of these stories that they were telling. But it was a way for them to relax, because they were really, other than going to Europe, playing the college circuit was really new to them, because the Chitlin' circuit that they were on was sort of dying out, and this was a whole new adventure for these great musicians.
How long did you have this relationship?
Oh, a very long time. There was a book, Marty Scorsese put out a series, a blues series that was on video, but there was a gentleman by the name of Peter Gurlnick who put together a book from that series, and I personally think that the book transcended the actual DVDs from the films. And there's a little story in there that Pete encouraged me to write about my meeting Muddy. And this went on for many years.
One of the things you say about Muddy Water, you describe how he was dressed. And you say, "Muddy was always impeccably dressed, elegant gray suit with an off-color white shirt, perfectly knotted tie, manicured fingernails." And I'm reading this comparing it to how I figured you were dressing at the time, which was probably like jeans, T-shirt. And so I guess, seeing that kind of like elegant dress and how important it was to Muddy Waters, what impact did that have on you when you became a performer?
Well, a big impact, because you see, I understood it, because going to the Apollo for all these years, dress was it was so important. The idea of the whole aspect of your stage clothes and the car that you had, it gave you a credibility. And there was a sort of formal, classical sense of you didn't wear regular clothes on stage. it would have been blasphemy. It just would have been an insult to the audience. You had to really put on the nines. You had to really spark up. And that was part of your job as a musician. And if you see all the early big bands, everybody was dressed up. You just, that was part of the requirement.
Yes, but you came of age during the counterculture when a lot of people on stage were dressing in jeans and T-shirts.
Yeah, but not me. if I wore jeans, they were black. And if I wore shoes, they were pointy. And if I wore shirts, they had ruffles on it, because I, too, was affected by it. And the whole counterculture, the whole Woodstock era, I was a sort of the odd man out with all of that. I was very much being born in the Bronx and growing up in the Bronx. There was a sort of rock tradition, and it was pointy black boots, black jeans, black shirt, slick back hair, and black jacket, sometimes leather, sometimes not. And that stayed with me for quite a long time.
My guest, Peter Wolf, will be back in the second half of the show. His new album is called Midnight Souvenirs. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with singer and songwriter Peter Wolf. He's just released his 7th solo album. It's called Midnight Souvenirs. From the late 60s to 1983, he was the frontman of the Jay Giles Band. His music reflects his love of rhythm and blues, blues, and country music. I want to play something else from your new CD, Midnight Souvenirs, and I guess I have an odd reason for playing it here. This strikes me as a kind of loving parody of a certain kind of rhythm and blues song from, I'd say, the late 60s, early 70s. The song is called Overnight Lows.
Oh, yeah.
And it just strikes me as you kind of paying tribute to a kind of song that isn't really you, but that you really love.
Well, yes, this is an homage to the great Philly sound.
Yeah, exactly.
Which is called
yeah.
the Philly sound. And Gamblin' Huff and Tom Bell and gentlemen who just, not unlike Motown, that in a very short period of time produced such great, great songs, great production that had a certain kind of charm. And songs would start out where, like, you know, hello, my name is Steve, I'm an Aquarius, and these raps and that would build into these beautiful melodies, beautiful songs. And this was an homage to that, not a parody, but just a way of showing the great love and trying to capture, maybe in our own way, some of the charm.
With irony.
Yes. Lots of irony.
And is that the only way you could do a song like this, with the love rap in the beginning, if you did
well,
it with
no,
irony?
Well, no, it's not the only way to do it, but many of those songs had these kinds of raps. It was just being something like working with somebody like Don Covey and people like that. And on stage, when I would perform with the Giles Band, I would do these love raps, Pewter the Buter, and, you know, love comes once, and when it comes, you got to grab it fast. Ain't no telling how long the love you grab is going to last. And that's why, baby, I'm knocking at your door, and I'm saying, baby, baby, and things. So those were things that I learned from the Apollo. Those are things that I learned from listening to a lot of the Philly music. So it was something that we felt, if we could do it with respect and dignity and charm, let's try it. So that's what we attempted to accomplish.
Okay, well, this is really fun. This is Overnight Lows, and this is from Peter Wolf's new CD, Midnight Souvenirs.
Some people are always running away from love. I guess I've been doing that for a long, 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 long time. And when I first met you at Audrey's house, well, you know, I didn't think much about it. But then I realized you were looking at me, and I was looking at you, and you were looking at me, I was looking at you, and all of a sudden we're looking at each other together. But baby, now I realize lovers can never say goodbye. So I was a fool, girl, to let you walk away. I didn't care why, I thought I'd find somebody else.
So I told you, girl, you go on, do your own thing. Now after a while, I realized the mistakes I made. You know I can't take back the words I said, and I can't undo the things I've done. But tonight, you know tonight I'm sitting here in the kitchen, right in the dark, sitting all alone in my underwear with a cold bologna sandwich and a confused heart there, girl. And let me tell you something. Oh, listen. Call me. Oh, call me, girl. Yeah. I'm so lonely.
Over my highs, over my lows, walking around, nowhere to go.
I got nowhere to go.
Opener at Lowe's from Peter Wolf's new CD, Midnight Souvenirs. And producing this must have been fun too, you know, getting like the strings and the backup singers.
Oh, yeah. And as we produced it, we really, our respect for these type of recordings from that era grew even stronger. And then there was like, hey, where's a sitar guitar? Who knows where we can get a sitar guitar? And boy, you know, it's not as easy as you think. So, yes, this one was a lot of fun.
So when you had a band called The Hallucinations, and then...
Oh, yeah.
And then it was Jay Giles after that. You met right. The people in Jay Giles and had the Jay Giles band, which was initially like more of a blues band. But when you started to perform with that band, did you have to create a stage persona for yourself as the front man? Figure out like how you're going to put yourself together, what kind of movement or dancing you were going to do on stage, you know, what the whole personality of you would be.
Well, The Hallucinations, the first band you mentioned, I was in art school. I really didn't quite graduate high school, so I spent a good deal of time hitchhiking around the country, pretending I was an art student and just walking into a university. And someone told me about the Boston Museum School of Fine Arts. And so I got there and brought in the paintings, and they told me it's like a $7 admission fee or something. And weeks later, I ended up getting this scholarship, and I was accepted to the school, and that brought me to Boston. And I was looking for a place to stay, and this gentleman comes up to me and asked if I knew somebody was looking for a place to stay, and I said, yeah, I am. And it turned out to be David Lynch, the filmmaker. And David and I lived together in Boston for about a year. And he went off to start movies. And I went off to join this band called The Hallucinations, who were made up of all art students. And we were like a neo-punk band. We were so entrenched in this music, we didn't really quite know how to play it so well. But we had 10-foot guitar chords, and we would jump into the audience and just go totally wild, which eventually happened years later at CBGB's, where many of the bands would just, it was just total energy.
Were you uninhibited from the start?
Yes. I think if I gave it any thought, I would never do it. And I was really had, I had a great, I almost had a nervous breakdown at one point because I was painting all my life and the music became, I was getting so transfixed in it, and I was painting less and less, and I knew I might have to leave school. And the idea of being a musician frightened me because, you know, was I crazy? Was this like just a silly dream? Was this just an adolescent dream? And there was a place called Mass Mental. It was a hospital, an actual mental hospital where you could hear people in cages screaming from the windows and stuff. And I was so having such anxiety about leaving this great, was all my life I was painting, that I once walked into this place and said, I think I need to be here. And this doctor said, why? I said, Doc, I'm just really nervous. And he said, well, what's the bad? I said, well, I want to do this music thing, but I've been working so hard with the painting. And he said, well, Peter, You know, you can, why don't I suggest this? Take a year, and you can always go back to school, but you're not, you might not be able to pursue this dream with your friends if you have this band. And give yourself a year, and if it doesn't work out, go back to school. And if it works out, well, then the question will be answered. And it seems such a simple solution that this great weight was lifted off of me. And I remember walking out of there, and I felt, yeah, this is what I can do. I could really dedicate my life to this for this next year. And that happened, and I never looked back.
As an art student, which you were for years, did you know that you could sing?
Oh, no. Terry, I consider myself a music fan, and there are singers that I respect. I don't put myself in that category. I am still learning about singing, and I feel I'm just starting to get there.
Well, is this why you were so afraid to become a musician, because you felt like you were a fan of music, but you really couldn't sing?
Well, first of all, would it help? I was dyslexic, and the idea of music, learning stuff, became so hard. Where so many of my friends could, you know, pick up a song real quickly, and for me to have to learn the song, I almost had to go through three different processes in my brain to somehow, in this dyslexic way, to get the song.
Even if you were singing it, if it was just the melody, or you're talking about playing an instrument?
All of it. I mean, the melodies, everything. It comes to me very, it's not an easy thing. It's very, very hard. I have to do a tremendous amount of work before I can really feel somewhat comfortable for it.
So what do you do to learn a song?
Well, I'm a great believer in collaboration. And for instance, I just performed a song in tribute to Jesse Stone, who was a great songwriter. I did a lot of songs for Shake, Rattle, and Roll, a lot of songs for Ray Charles, and was one of the great Brill Building songwriters. And he had a song that Clyde McFadden from the Drifters sang called Money Honey. It's not a complicated song, but to get it right, it took me a while, and I just sat down with some friends, and we just went over it and drilled it and went over it and drilled it, and until it sort of becomes second nature, and I have to do that.
My guest is singer and songwriter Peter Wolf. His new album is called Midnight Souvenirs. We'll talk more and hear more of his music after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Peter Wolf. He has a new solo CD, which is called Midnight Souvenirs. I say solo, but there's some really great duets on it, too, including duets with Shelby Lynn and Merle Haggard. And you've had such an interesting life. You know, I mean, you were also a DJ at WBCN, which became like the big progressive rock, or a big progressive rock station in Boston. But you were there on the station as a DJ when it first switched to a, you know, progressive rock format. And tell us the name of your on-air character.
Oh, I was the Wolf of Goof of Mama Tufa. Peter Wolf, making your knees freeze, your bladder splatter, sitting, it's got to come out, welcoming the OJs, the little ladies of the night, kid from Alabama, keeping it all here, doing a tune, getting a little fun, going to be rocking it out until the sun, so give us a call, and don't just stall, doing it to it and getting right through it. If it's in you, it's got to come out. So come on, baby, let's scream and shout. And that went on for from midnight to 7 in the morning. And since it was the only real music that was pounding away on the FM airwaves, when musicians would come to town, they heard about it, and they would listen and come in. And so I got to interview people like Roland Kirk. I got to interview Carla Thomas. I got to interview Helen Wolf. I got to interview Muddy Waters, Van Morrison, Jimmy Page, Robert Plant. I can't even think of so many people that stopped by.
No, you know, it's interesting. Like, you had your radio show and this, like, great persona, and played great stuff and all this rhyming stuff. Your father had a radio show, too, right, called The Boy Baritone?
He was the boy baritone, and it was in the era where they would have singers. The song pluggers is what it was called. And they would sometimes be in department stores and music stores, and there would be a piano player, and sheet music was very important. And so if you heard a song, people would buy the sheet music, and they would go home, and many people had Paula pianos. And that's how you learn songs, and people would learn the latest songs. And my dad had a show, 15-minute show, Alan Blankfield Boy Baritone, and he would sing the latest songs from Tin Pan Alley, and the publishers would give him the song, and there'd be a pianist, and he'd sing the songs. And if you liked the songs, you would go to your local record store or furniture store, where a lot of recording stuff was sold, and buy the sheet music.
So I'm just thinking about how different those two radio shows were. Your father's from the song plugging era were. The main thing was to sell sheet music, and your show.
They were very different, but you see, I would go with my father, with his brother, who managed my father, also managed a champion baton twirler, managed the world's strongest man, and a gorilla, and they would his office was at the Automat off of 42nd Street. Right next to Jack Dempsey's. And they would all meet, and this was sort of like a Broadway Danny Rose film that Woody Allen did. There'd be people with parrots and this and that. And these people had a different act. One guy would do different voices or imitate cars, and one would do bird whistles. And they were all there, and everyone would sit around the table, and they'd all talk about work or out of work, and everyone had a copy of Variety under their arm. And
did you feel any connection to that when you got into the music business? Like when the Jay Giles Band was really popular, did you feel any connection to that old school vaudeville era that your father was from?
Well, there was a commitment. It was something that you were honored to be there. And I think one of the things about the Giles Band I'm very proud of is we worked really hard on stage, and we really gave it 110%.
Did you ever expect that the Giles Band would actually have hits?
No, we never expected the Giles Band would even get out of Boston. That's why it was called the Jay Giles Band, because when the Hallucinations broke up, this first band of art students, they were all going off in these artist retreats and things, and some of them were just getting a little bit too crazy. And I met Jay, who was very serious, and he and the harmonica player Magic Dick and the bass player, they really were great students of the music I loved, and we put it together. But he had a manager that didn't quite like me and was afraid that I was going to steal Jay away or something. So he said, if you want to play with Jay, you can play with Jay, but it has to be under the name Jay Giles. And so I said, I don't care, you know, we just want to play music. And that lasted for about a year and a half. And within that time, we built such a big following. And you're in New England, you're not thinking about the bigger world. And we figured, well, people know us in New England. Bill Graham invited us down to the Fillmore East. And we were to open up for Black Sabbath. And people were wanting Black Sabbath, Black Sabbath. And they were just sort of screaming out, and then Bill, who'd never seen us before, got out to the audience and said, ladies and gentlemen, I invited this band to come and play. I've never seen them before. I think some of you are being really rude. People don't want to see this band. I'll allow you with your ticket stubs to leave and come back in afterwards. But I would like to see this band, and I'd appreciate it if you give me and other people like to see this band the opportunity. And we went out on stage. And five encores later, Bill was just enraptured. He came upstage and he walked in the dressing room and came up to me and says, Jay, you are fantastic. I said, Bill, I'm not Jay. He goes, you're not? I go, no. I said, I'm Pete Wolves. Well, who the hell is Jay Giles? And I said, well, that is the guitar player. He goes, why is that? And I go, oh, well, don't get me started. So that's how it all began.
My guest is singer and songwriter Peter Wolf. His new album is called Midnight Souvenirs. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is singer and songwriter Peter Wolf. He has a new solo album called Midnight Souvenirs. When we left off, we were talking about his years as the frontman of the Jay Giles Band. Do you have a favorite of the Jay Giles tracks?
No, but I do have a favorite album. And the favorite album for me, and the template of the Jay Giles Band, was an album put together by James Brown live at the Apollo Volume 1. And that was an album that James Record Company didn't want to make. James funded it himself. And to me, the way that record starts and doesn't stop and song leads into song is the same from seeing many of the shows at the Apollo when I was putting together the Giles Band. That was the formula we used for our shows. And so I think the album that to me, I would say represents the band that I love is an album called Full House that was recorded in our adopted city of Detroit. And it's like the decisive moment of J. Giles Band on stage, and it's a communion between us and the audience, and the energy is captured in there. And because of that, I think it's my favorite.
Let's play something from that. Do you want to choose a track?
Well, maybe either First I Look at the Purse or Hard Drive a Man or Looking for a Love, Bobby Womack song. Either or, Lady's Choice.
I think I'm going to go with Looking for a Love. That's my guest, Peter Wolf, with the J. Giles Band. Peter Wolf has a new solo CD, which is called Midnight Souvenirs. Now, you were talking about how Live at the Apollo, James Brown Live at the Apollo, was kind of like your model for a while. But you didn't have, like, a guy introducing you as, like, the greatest, the way James Brown did.
No. We didn't have, ladies and gentlemen, it is star time.
Exactly, yeah.
But what we did have is the band would go out and do a couple of instrumentals, and then I would walk out. And I remember being playing in Worcester, Mass, and I had these patent leather shoes and tight peg pants and ruffled shirt and a jacket and all these kind of fake diamond rings on. And we were opening up for this lady by the name of Janis Joplin. And she was watching the band from the side doing this instrumental, and we were kicking it in pretty hard. And she looked at me and she said, "Man, who's that band?" I said, "That's the J. Giles Band." And she said, "Are they instrumental band?" I said, "No." She says, "Well, where's the singer?" I said, "Hold on, honey." And I walked out and I started singing. And all of a sudden I could see her walking out into the audience and sitting smack in the front row. And she watched the entire show. And then backstage, we got together and spent many a night yakking and talking. And she was, because, you know, we came from the same place. She loved the R&B music. She came out of, I believe, Texas and understood all the country honky-tonk. And it was a melting pot for us. And she too believed in the show was the thing. You can sing the song, you can do a record, but if people are going to come see you, you gotta give it to them. You got to get down there and sweat for them.
Is there anybody that you don't know? It's just, you seem to know everybody.
Well, I don't know, Terry.
You're roommates with David Lynch.
Right.
You knew Van Morrison just on the cusp of his fame. Did you tour with the Beatles?
I never toured with the Beatles, but I spent many good quality time with every Beatle except Ringo Starr. And I have some fun stories of John Lennon during the Lost Weekend and Harry Nilsson.
Oh, you could tell one of those.
Oh, they're all kind of episodic. But there was a lot of Remy Martin and Milk and Harry Nilsson, and it went on for several days and several nights, and we ended up in a studio with Jimmy Iovine, became quite a big producer and who's still involved in the music industry. He was the engineer. I was singing. John was playing guitar. Harry Nilsson was on drums. I don't know how he appeared, the bass player for Alice Cooper. And while we were recording all this stuff, in came Paul Simon and Art Garfunkel with this lady that I think maybe Paul was dating by the name of Diane Keaton, who was just singing, I think, at the Blue Angel or something before she got into acting. And it just ended up being this, like, two-day craziness where Harry, John, and I would get out and, let's put it this way, too much too soon, too quick, too fast. And there were a lot of adventures that I think time would not allow. But the cognac and milk flowed freely.
Peter Wolf, it's really been fun to talk with you. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you so very much.
Peter Wolf's new album is called Midnight Souvenirs. You can hear two tracks from it on our website, his duet with Merle Haggard, It's Too Late for Me, and his duet with Shelby Lynn, Tragedy.